interesting weather. This is kind of like Dharma rain, and you can tell it's Sunday because there's the smell of fried chicken in the air from the Thai temple. It's all pervasive. Dogen didn't ask whether the wind of the frying chicken reaches everywhere. So we're going to continue. Yes.
I actually had a question about yesterday.
Yeah.
Can I ask it now, or do you want
me
to wait?
Let me read something quickly and make a couple comments, and then before we go in, before we start the text.
Can you make sure people have materials who want them?
Yeah, do people have, if anybody would like the text, who wasn't here yesterday, we have extra copies.
On the Shira?
Yeah. Ross, can you turn this down just a little bit?
Sure.
Thank you.
Keep talking.
All right, I'm talking. That sounds okay, yeah. Okay, can you hear?
Uh-huh.
Good. I just wanted to read you something from, a couple of thoughts by way of introduction. One is, we're going to continue discussing Dogen's fascicle Zenki and then move to Shoji, and these are intimately related. In the kind of his editorial comment to Shoji, the Dogen translator Nishijima says this, and I think this is really good and relevant. Although the words life and death exist in all languages, Master Dogen says that we are not able to understand intellectually what our life and death are. He says that their meaning is embedded in our real day-to-day life. In this chapter, he explains life and death as the real momentary state at the present moment. In our daily life, life and death both exist in undivided wholeness. So to me, the heart of this is we're not able to understand this intellectually, and that the meaning is embedded in our real day-to-day life itself. So that's part of the context of this making a mistake on purpose, talking about these issues. And it put me in mind this morning. Yesterday I was talking briefly about Katagiri Roshi. There's another experience of Katagiri Roshi that I think actually speaks to this question. And you should excuse me if you heard this before. I have come to the age, actually, if you ask my children, I reached this age probably about 15 years ago, where you only have a certain number of stories, and you tend to tell them. And not only don't you remember whether you've told them before, but also where or when. So you may have heard this, but I went to do sesshin with Katagiri Roshi in Hokkyoji on the Minnesota-Iowa border, and this was in the late-ish 80s. And one day he said, tomorrow I'm going to tell you all about birth, death, karma, and rebirth. And we got really excited. It's like, we're really going to hear what this is about. He promised us. And he was particularly going to talk about rebirth. And the next day he showed up and he kind of verbally rambled about for 15 or 20 minutes and finally said, I'm sorry, I can't talk about this. The problem is, I believe and you don't believe. That was it. So we're actually left on our own to work this out. Dogen is giving us suggestions and pointing us in certain ways. I also I came across something. I was reading the brand new New Yorker because there was an article that caught my attention last night called "How to Be Good," about an Oxford philosopher by the name of Derek Parfit, who I had never heard of. Has anyone heard of him? Evidently, he's a very influential philosopher, but I don't read philosophy. So let me just read you what this woman writes really well, Larissa McFarquhar. And again, this, I think, has some relevance. Suppose that a scientist were to begin replacing your cells one by one with those of Greta Garbo at the age of 30. At the beginning of the experiment, the recipient of the cells would clearly be you. At the end, it would clearly be Garbo. But what about in the middle? It seems implausible to suggest that you could draw a line between the two, that any single cell could make the difference, all the difference between you and not you. There is, then, no answer to the question of whether or not the person is you. And yet, there is no mystery involved. We know what happened. A self, it seems, is not all or nothing, but the sort of thing that there can be more or less of. When, in the process of a zygote's cellular self-multiplication, does a person start to exist? Or when does a person descending into dementia or coma cease to be? There is no simple answer. It is a matter of degrees. And then she writes, Parfit's view resembles in some way the Buddhist view of the self, a fact that was pointed out to him by a professor of Oriental religions. Parfit was delighted by this discovery. And he was delighted to find out that a figure like the Buddha, vastly removed from him by time and space, came independently to a similar conclusion. Well, that was extremely reassuring. And then just later in this piece, she writes, it seems to a friend of Parfit's that his theory of personal identity is motivated by an extreme fear of death. But Parfit doesn't believe that he once feared death more than other people, and now he thinks he fears it less. He writes, my death will break the more direct relations between my present experience and future experiences, but it will not break other relations. My death will break the more direct relations between my present experiences and future experiences, but it will not break various other relations. Then she writes, some people will remember him. Others may be influenced by his writing or act upon his advice. Memories that connect with his memories, thoughts that connect with his thoughts, actions taken that connect with his intentions will persist after he's gone, just inside different bodies. And then he writes, this is all there is to the fact that there will be no one living who will be me. Now that I have seen this, my death seems to me less bad. So anyway, I thought that was relevant, the idea of to this idea of what continues? Who am I? And how we can't, both we know what our self is, we know what our life is, we know what our death is, and as Dogen is pointing out, it is always beyond our understanding. So this is just sort of a little appetizer before we go into this. But tomorrow, your question.
Yes, I wanted to go back to the paragraph about the boat.
Yes.
Life is like riding the boat.
Yeah.
Although you row the boat, you need to ride, and without the boat, no one could ride. The thing that I was struggling with is, I guess I was kind of imagining a triathlon. Dogen's view of a triathlon. So you have a person, you know, swimming, running, biking. You know, and each time it's like being in the boat. You know, there's mm-hmm. no swimming, there's no, especially the bike. You know, the bike is similar to boat. But it kind of seemed to me that it could be misunderstood, the metaphor could be misunderstood to imagine that you have a sort of immortal soul, you know, like the man or the woman, the person riding the boat, somehow has an existence apart from the boat. So I was kind of confused about that, because I'm sure that's not our understanding, and it made me wonder if there was something I was missing in the metaphor. You know, I kind of understand the part about this whole world being born once the person steps into the boat, and the world kind of ending once you step out of it. But I wonder about.
I think that the the reason that I don't think of it as this kind of immortal or essential you, I think that's what you're asking about.
Well, something that say gets reincarnated after you die. Something that persists. You finish sailing the boat, e.g., you die, is the metaphor.
Right.
But yet you go on and get on the bicycle.
Right. Oh, okay.
Some fairly intact, organized thing moves from one existence to another, even though each existence is, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, he would probably say something to the effect that each of those is a different being. You know, it's the boat riding being and the bicycle riding being. But then there's the conundrum of the fact that something, we do have a perception of something continuing.
Yeah.
Certainly not immortal, but there is something that we conveniently call the self, and we recognize that's going from one of these triathlon activities to the other. And it has a momentary, it has, I think this is what we're going to get to later in this, that one birth and death do not hinder another birth and death. In other words, you're born and die within one activity, but there are many activities that each of us undertake, and they don't hinder each other. Does that make some sense?
I'd like to see other people.
Yeah, yeah, Ken.
But they do condition each other.
Yes, yes, they condition each other.
So you're conditioned by what has come before, but you're still fully free in your present.
Right. This is what Dogen.
Except for the conditioning.
Okay. Can you say it louder?
Your circumstances, your existence is conditioned by what's happened before, but you're still fully free within your circumstances.
If I was in jail the moment before, in the next moment, I'm still in jail. So it ain't freedom. There's a lot of restriction on your freedom from the previous circumstance, and the conditions that lead to the next.
But being in jail is a condition.
Yeah.
But there are other conditions in jail. So you can feel free in jail or contained in jail, depending upon much more than just the condition of the structure that you're in.
Well, yeah, I was just using that as an example. There's the whole mental karma that a personality has that conditions the next moment of the person's state.
Ah, but that... So did you hear that, what he said? Did you...
Mental condition. I heard him. I listened. Yeah.
Say it again.
Say it again a little louder. Just...
The most relevant condition, it seems to me, the condition of my present moment is my, you know, human karma, which is, you know, from the previous moment. You know, if I'm in a bad mood in the previous moment, I'm going to be in a bad mood in the present one, though apparently things can change imperceptibly over infinite moments lasting 5 minutes.
Right. So this is actually your... pointing to a central question about the Buddhist notion of karma.
Actually, what I'm getting is, what is the freedom that is being referred to? It's not, I'm taking it that word differently, and I think you meant it.
No. Okay, so Mary and then John?
Yeah. I think the conditioning is different than being determined. And that conditioning is not an inevitability. But it is a circumstance about which one is either knowing about or not knowing about, or choosing about or not choosing about. Yes, I mean, if I didn't get enough sleep last night, then I'm tired. I have a choice. That's a conditioning, but I have a choice about how to meet that with more or less freedom. That circumstance, right?
John.
Maybe there's a choice.
What came up for me in response to what you said, and what you said. We're conditioned, this current moment is conditioned by the mood of the previous moment. If I'm in a bad mood, I could be limited by that. And so then how could I be free? How could there be freedom at the same time as I'm conditioned? As this moment is conditioned. And that makes sense to me, but there's something about that freedom may exist in a certain way with the recognition of it. And maybe in the moment when we're totally under the thrall of the conditioning of the previous moment, we're not recognizing the freedom. But I don't know if that makes mm-hmm. sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of freedom in knowing that mood is not me.
Yes. And this is, you know, this was one of the things that was radical about the Buddha's notion of karma, which was sort of stood in opposition to the societal notion of karma that preceded it. Dharma meant duty, and karma really meant your fate, which was determined by your last moment, your last life, and that the proper way to meet that karmic thrust was to live in the position that fate seems to have assigned you. In other words, to live in your caste, to live in your job, to live in your gender, whatever. What the Buddha said was, which was radical, is that, yes, karma is determined by past volitional actions, and in each moment as it arises, you have a choice as to how to act.
A couple quotes from a different context, but probably relevant. Hegel says, freedom is awareness of necessity.
Mm.
And Marx said, man makes his own history, but not under the conditions that he chooses.
Right.
Or within conditions that he doesn't necessarily choose.
Right, and there's this... I don't think you and I have talked about. There's this. I gave a talk here. There's this Sri Lankan Buddhist scholar, Nalin Suarez, who passed away a little while ago, who was a Marxist, and you know that's exactly what he's doing. He's not putting forward a political philosophy, but he's looking at conditionality and the possibility of freedom even within those conditions, including social conditions. And he's arguing that the Buddha did that. There was a dimension of his teaching that was socially radical because it was actually attacking the heart of the ideological heart of the caste system. But this is a little off topic, perhaps. But I'm thinking about, you know, what you said about I'm still in jail. I teach at this prison, and one of the things that came up last week was just, we had a discussion. I said, well, why are you here? You know, why have you come to this meditation group? And, you know, it was precisely about finding some measure of freedom within the conditions, which they were acknowledging and I was acknowledging as the conditions are oppressive. You know, they're about social control, they're about punishment, and, you know, in some cases they're, you know, legal punishment for crimes that actually have been committed. But still, how do we turn this within our lives? So it's okay, I'd like to go on. So moving through, I'm on section, I think it's section 8. This being so, is that 8? This being so, the undivided activity of birth and death is like a young man bending and stretching his arm. Or it is like someone asleep reaching with his hand behind his back for the pillow. This is realization in vast, wondrous light. So, what Sojin says in the lecture I was quoting is he's talking about the bending and stretching the arm, or bending and extending the arm. One position is like birth, the other is like death. And these are movements of the same arm, that it can move this way, it can move this way, same arm. And, you know, he's not saying, and we can't say, which one is life and which one is death. It's just, it has this potentiality for contraction or expansion. You know, this is, let's see. Yes.
While you're searching, may I say something? I had an interesting experience this morning while getting a key.
Okay.
And that was, you know, I bent and stretched my arm. I didn't think anything about it. And as I looked for the key, up came a key, and it had the name of someone who used to live here, who's now deceased. Dolly's name was on the key fob. And you know, I'm thinking about how you know, dead or alive, that koan, and how, like, in this sangha, there are a number of people who passed away. Like, we have Rebecca's statues and sangha members' pictures in the garden shed. And I wonder if that some kind of enactment of that koan, dead or alive, you know, because Dolly's name was there, that I, you know, it stimulated these thoughts and memories about Dolly and her passing and so on, and how sometimes I felt her presence here.
So that was a Zen key. You don't know how much money I gave her to do that.
No charge.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to me to be what related to what Parfit was saying in that New Yorker article, that in that moment, a Dolly is alive to you, right? And comes back very vividly. You know, as we were talking about Rebecca yesterday, I was remembering her very clearly. I'm sure other people were. That's a kind of life. It's alive. It's a life that extends. What I like about the Parfit piece is like, it's a life that exists within other bodies. You know, that physical body, Dolly's, is gone, but her life persists in other various ways. The quotation, just to say, I'm looking for a citation. This bending and extending, Dr. Abe says, it's from Kamuro Yojo Kyo Meditation Sutra. But he says the same thing: bending and extending are both total activities of the same arm, which do not hinder each other. Just as birth and death, the two great movements of the universe, are each total, mutually unhindering activities of that universe. And then the second expression, we've heard before, was like someone asleep reaching with her hand behind her back for the pillow. And that's referencing case 89 in the Blue Cliff record, the hands and eyes of great compassion. What does the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara do with her thousand hands and eyes? And actually, the person who's responding is also Dawu from the condolence call. This is his koan, and he says, it's like reaching around in the middle of the night for a pillow. This is for some reason, this is always a very powerful image to me, because you do this, it's as if it were in Zazen. It's like we go through a 40-minute period of Zazen, and what happened? You know, who knows? Just like when in our sleep, we don't know what happens. But we just automatically reach around behind our head to put the pillow at just the right angle to give ourselves ease, right? And unlike our conscious waking life, when we're sometimes dogged by self-consciousness and questions of self-worth, there's not a person in this room or in the world, I think, who wakes up enough to ask themselves the question, do I deserve to put my head at a comfortable angle? You know, we do this with other things. You know, do I deserve to be at ease? You know, do I you know, does this other person deserve to be at ease? It's just like there's no thought about that. You just do this. And you do it unthinkingly, automatically, and perfectly. And
that is the meaning of this phrase, that it's, the point is that it's this automatic, unquestioning.
The meaning of the phrase is that it's automatic. That, you know, what that the bodhisattva's activity is.
Direct.
Is, yeah, exactly. Automatic, direct. And she has all of these arms. And the way that the koan continues, Ungan says, Dogo says, how do you understand this, what I've just said? And Ungan says, well, it's like having hands all over your body. And Dawu says, well, you've got it, you've got half of it. And Ungan says, well, what's the other half? He said, all through your body are hands and eyes. So your entire functioning, this gets back to Zenki, your entire functioning is about creating, without thinking, creating a harmonious, unified activity in your body.
There was there was some guy, I forget who it is, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, a guest speaker who gave a talk in which he used the example of like you step on a thorn.
It was Gil, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you pull out the thorn.
Right.
And he, I can't even remember what his point was, but he sort of used that as an example of directly confronting a situation and responding to
right.
it. And so he said there could be this thorn in your heart and you're right. trying to pull it out, and this is what Buddhism is about. So, but I think it reminds me of this because he was attempting to make Buddhism or some aspect of Buddhism so elementary and commonsensical that there would be no question about it. You would just say, of course, you pull out the thorn, and maybe it's hard to pull out or da-da-da, but it's just an automatic thing that you do. You wouldn't have to justify it or anything, and it seems connected with this.
Yeah, I think it's similar, and of course, pulling out a thorn is probably not as straightforward and simple as that, but in a narrative way it is. It's just very direct. This is a very direct koan. Gil's Vipassana approach it's very nuts and bolts. It's very direct. That was what was, to me, it was very refreshing. Whereas we circle around and circle around. We have a different kind of discourse. But in that case, it's a kind of automatic response. But I think that the response, what Dogen is pointing at here, I think, is true in both cases. You do what you're trained to do. You know, some things are trained by your actual physical body. So if there's a thorn, you would instinctively pull it out if you had the means to do that. Other things we're trained to do, we're so, the complexity of, say, something, the life of a sesshin is so complicated. You know, you've been head server for the last 2 days. You're really well trained as head server. You don't think so much about, I would guess, about the particular steps of that activity, right? Because you have them in your body. And this is one of the things that we're trying to do with practice, is to develop these to develop this sense of appropriate action in our body in a very wide way. And that's a manifestation of our life. So, it's like someone reaching around with his hand with her hand behind her back for the pillow. And then the final piece of this is realization in vast, wondrous light, which is one of Sojin's favorite koans. It sort of refers, Buddhism is always talking about light. In this case, one reference would be case 86 in the Blue Glucquif record, Yunmen's light. Yunmen taught, everyone has her own light. When you try to see it, you can't. The darkness is dark, dark. Now, what is your light? So again, this is like you could call the light our life, and you call the darkness our death, but they're not separate. They're part of one reality. Everyone has their own light, and also everyone has their own darkness and shadow. And then in the next section, he gets to the conclusion. He says, about just such a moment, you may suppose that because realization is manifested in undivided activity, there was no realization prior to this. In other words, everything moves towards one realization. But what he's saying is, however, prior to this realization, undivided activity was manifested. There's realization after realization. There's realization possible. Realization meaning your awareness of the moment that you're in, or as we were saying yesterday, perhaps you can't say whether it's your awareness or it's your memory of just infinitesimally the moment before. Because as soon as the mind works, we're in the next moment. He says, but undivided activity manifested previously does not hinder the present realization of undivided activity. Because of this, your understanding can be manifested moment after moment. And that's his conclusion. Yeah, Ken?
A really great kind of response to the question of being in a bad mood. It's like the bad mood does not hinder you from waking up to your to what's going on. And I think there is something about awareness of your bad mood that completely changes it.
Well, it can. It also strikes me as, in tomorrow's, to go back to the triathlon, you actually have to demonstrate your ability in these different modalities of action. And one, being skilled at one doesn't necessarily imply that you're going to be skilled at the other one. And, you have to move seamlessly from one to the next, functioning. One of the things I was realizing last night, thinking about both this and Shoji, which we will move to in a few minutes, is that, and then trying to think whether this held true for other fascicles of Dogen, and this is just my thought of the moment, is that there's a motion in this fascicle and in Shoji from beginning with like this great complexity, you know, that where you can hardly get your mind around what he's talking of, and moving towards a more practical and straightforward conclusion that points towards practice and points towards something you can do. And I thought of this as in relation to say an improvisation, a musical improvisation, how I construct a guitar solo. And you know, a lot of improvisations move from they'll state the melody and move towards increasing complexity. And just it's kind of not the way I've done things. Usually when I play, it moves at the end, what I'll do is something fairly simple and clear, melodically clear, and that was just I never thought about it, but that was just a sort of intuitive thing. But I realized thinking about this is, well, it's nice to leave somebody with a melody, or it's nice to leave someone with something that's been really plainly or simply stated, because then that sets the stage for then they can move to the next moment. So that may be over generalizing, but I think in both of these, just this one closes, but undivided activity manifested previously does not hinder the present realization of undivided activity. Because of this, your understanding can be manifested moment after moment, which means we're not getting, we have the opportunity not to get in our own way, right? But to actually find freedom even in circumstances that look very difficult. And then at the end of Shoji, as we'll read it, you know, he said there's an easy way to become a Buddha. And then he gives you this kind of shopping list of activities after beginning in a very complicated way. But tomorrow. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to comment. I think it's kind of interesting that he uses being asleep as an exemplar of realization, because usually we talk about awakening.
Right.
Waking up from our dream and being awake. And then in this section, it's being asleep that is realization. It's our activity while we're sleeping that is most realized. It's just interesting to me that he kind of turns that really conventional image of realization on its head like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, he certainly is known for doing that, but this is even more unusual. It's pretty much on its head, but you know, he's also pointing to something that we can all recognize in a human way, I think. Paul?
I'm not recognizing it. And to be contrary again,
okay.
It's not obvious to me that this person reaching behind their head is asleep. It's just something that, I mean, I imagine me doing it, I'm not necessarily asleep. It's an instinctive activity. But maybe they were asleep. I'm not saying that that isn't what's going on.
Well, it says right here, asleep.
Huh?
It says on the paper, asleep.
It doesn't say that.
It does.
Or are you reading? This being so, the undivided activity of birth and death like a young man bending and stretching his arm, or like someone asleep.
Okay. Wake up!
Go back to sleep.
Okay,
but no,
it doesn't change my question.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Here's my question about this: is that you know, why is that realization? And what's the connection between that and light? You talked about what light is
right.
in various different contexts, but you didn't say why this is an example of light, not only light, but wondrous light, and why this instinctive, unconscious activity is realization, which is something that seems to me is supposedly, unlike enlightenment, is something you actually cognize.
Mm.
I can live I can live an enlightened life and be enlightened according to Sojin, but realization is understanding something. And why is it, you know, that's many questions, just answer any one of them.
Okay. One second.
That's what I don't like about Dogen. He says things that are, you know, that are obvious, like birth doesn't hinder death. You know, I didn't need to be told that. Birth and death both happen. But that seems to be something important to say, an important point he has to make after saying something else. I don't see the connections between his statements very often.
Well, to me, I think this is this statement is being used as a concrete sort of to see it concretely and to see it metaphorically at the same time. Your whole what we're looking at is human activity, is human life. That's the whole subject of this, and taken within, and this is going to get to this leads directly to the next piece. Because this is the fundamental question that's posed at the beginning is, well, is this realization? He's saying it is. He's saying, try looking at it that way, mm-hmm. that try looking at it from the standpoint of, it's a miracle that you can do this. So, thinking about Kinhin, you know, seems like a very simple activity. Once you start really looking at the unlimited complexity of taking a step, then there's realization within that.
It's like saying just you know, being conscious of your in breath and your out breath is wondrous realization.
Yes.
Also.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I think that's what he's saying. And he's saying this realization is vast, wondrous light. There's a moment, there are moments when you feel this light. This is just completely, I can take a step. This is completely amazing. Usually we take it, the thing is, usually we take this for granted. But he's kind of been saying, it's not something special. And yet, it's extraordinary. At the same time, this is a simultaneity, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, in
yeah, go defense, ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
When I did Case 89, I seem to recall that the translation I used or that was given to me was, it's like someone in the middle of the night reaching behind their head for a pillow. Which sort of seems to refer to that liminal state between waking and sleeping.
I agree, yeah. I don't know about a sleep, frankly. You know, but...
it should work either way anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's like... that's the sort of translation that I've seen. It's like, you're sort of half asleep. You're in this liminal state. You're in between. But you don't...
It's like your conscious mind is not able to... is not functioning to kind of make judgments on what you're doing.
But something in your body is saying, put me at ease.
Right.
And something in your body is not consciously responding, not saying, okay, I'll do that. It's just doing that. Ronnie?
Well, I think, like, you know, this is about intuitive behavior. and how it's experiential and it's beyond words. You know, thank you, Dogen. I mean, we've heard so many words, but you know, there it is. Like, it's something, and I think it's something that we all have done, and we're not editing, we're not commenting on it. We just do it.
And also, for me, it speaks to that that state of being in an activity, and maybe it's something that you have learned so well that you can do it without guiding yourself by intellectual thought, and you drop away somehow, and somehow there is then only the activity rather than a commentary going on about the activity or anything else, actually. It's just the activity. And that, I don't know if this is relevant, but for some reason it... The way that we do forms, it never occurred to me that the way that one does forms could change depending upon the inner state one was in. I know that sounds kind of ordinary, but I mean, I was thinking about it in terms of doing Orioki and thinking about it from the point of view of doing everything just right and having that energy versus doing Orioki and doing it because one is feeling lovingly toward one's bowls or food, that there's a sense of kind of pervasive enjoyment or gratitude or some other that is not about the rightness of it or the correctness of it, that there's a different energy, even though you would do the same movement, that it would shine differently or look different somehow or feel different.
Well, I think Suzuki Roshi said something that, you know, when you're basically, I don't remember the exact quote, somebody might, you know, when you're sitting zazen, sitting upright facing the wall, when everyone is doing that, then I can see how you are. You know, I can see in that unified activity, which in certain sense is the same, he was able to see the particularity of each person's state. That's what he's saying, anyway. And I think that is something that is about how we manifest the forms. And I think, you know, aspects of practice that's coming up is the topic is the heart of our forms, or sort of the forms in our heart and our heart in the forms. How we manifest them, not how we do them right or wrong, but also within that, what are added, you know, how we're caught by right and wrong, and how we're free from right and wrong. So, Paul.
How about just one sentence out of section 7?
All right.
Even though there's many sentences there that I wonder why he's saying that, but just this one is the worst. There is undivided activity in what is not birth and not death. I'm surprised to hear him say finally, there's something that is not birth and death.
Let me look at another translation, okay?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Not birth and not death.
Okay. I mean, this is.
He answered me.
No, I think he's right. Ross is always right.
It's just like these other.
It's exactly.
It's like birth, but not birth.
It's like saying it's in A, and it's in not A,
right.
And it's in neither A nor not A, and it's in both A or not.
Yeah, but not birth is not, it is like the Heart Sutra in that it's, okay, don't get caught on something called birth, as apart from the whole works, which includes birth and death. Birth dash and dash death. Mia.
Yeah, it's really funny to think about, like, oh, this is so, what a strange, obvious thing to say, or just that whole quality of Dogen that you were talking about yesterday, where he sort of, like, covers all of the bases, like, oh, I'll say it's this, and then I'll say it's not that. Because then when you were reading that philosopher earlier, the main thing I noticed was how he had this idea of death as living on, and he's living on in other bodies. But then it occurs to me that then when somebody pointed out that this was the way that the Buddha thought about death, that he said that it was assuring to know that somebody else independently came to that same conclusion, instead of saying what seems obvious to me, which would be, oh, I must be one of those other bodies as a Buddha. So it was just really, I was like, oh, wow. And then, so in that sort of leaving that out, or not immediately going to that inclusion, but instead being assured of his independent thought or his particular abilities or something.
Well, I think he thought it was independent thought, you know? I mean, because he didn't know anything about Buddhism. And I think... it certainly, well, you know, I don't know, and I, you know, looking at other stuff in this article, I don't exactly understand his thinking, but he didn't come to it by way of Buddhism. Now, Buddhism may have been in there, but also, Buddhism is not the only intellectual tradition that would have these ideas. You know, it comes through all kinds of philosophical traditions and religious traditions, and it's not unique, but he felt reassured that 2,500 years ago somebody came to a very similar conclusion. I could, you know, that's understandable.
Well, sure. I mean, I guess I'm not really talking about the intellectual thought so much. I'm actually more, I like more his idea about, like, there's that somatic or, like, physical quality of it, like you finding the key, the Dalai's name, like, that sort of, it's not as, it's different from just, like, an intellectual progression, and so it's just interesting. There's no reason why he couldn't have said, like, oh, well, then I must be, you know, one of those other bodies.
Well, if you read more of this article, you see this guy's not living too much in his body. Somatic perceptions are not his strong suit. Okay, let's take a breath, and then I'd like to read. We have enough time to. I'd like to read Shoji, and, you know, and so that we can sort of begin this. I'd like to get to a bit of it. Okay, just stop and take 3 breaths together. So, you have a translation of Shoji? Let's start, let's go up the row from Marie. And just read a section at a time. Is it broken into sections? Mine isn't.
Yeah,
okay. And just follow along. Okay, Marie, why don't you begin?
Because the Buddha is in birth and death, there is no birth and death. It is also said, because a Buddha is not in birth and death, a Buddha is not deluded by birth and death.
These statements are the essence of the words of the two Zen masters, Jishan and Yingshan. You should certainly not neglect them, because they are the words of those who attain the way.
Those who want to be free from birth and death should understand the meaning of these words. If you search for a Buddha outside birth and death, it will be like trying to go to the southern country of youth with our spear headed towards the north. Or like trying to see the Big Dipper while you are facing south. You will cause yourself to remain all the more in birth and death and lose the way of emancipation.
Just understand that birth and death is itself nirvana. There is nothing such as birth and death to be avoided. There is nothing such as nirvana to be sought. Only when you realize this are you free from birth and death.
It is a mistake to suppose that birth turns into death. Birth is a phase that is an entire period of itself with its own past and future. For this reason, in Buddha Dharma, birth is understood as no birth. Death is a phase that is an entire period of itself, with its own past and future. For this reason, death is understood as no death.
In birth, there is nothing but birth, and in death, there is nothing but death. Accordingly, when birth comes, face and actualize birth. And when death comes, face and actualize death. Do not avoid them or desire them.
This birth and death is the life of Buddha. If you try to exclude it, you will lose the life of Buddha. If you cling to it, trying to remain in it, you will also lose the life of Buddha, and what remains will be the mere form of Buddha. Only when you don't dislike birth and death or long for them do you enter Buddha's mind.
However, do not analyze or speak about it. Just set aside your body and mind, forget about them, and throw them into the house of Buddha. Then all is done with Buddha. When you follow this, you are free from birth and death and become a Buddha without effort or calculation. Who then continues to think?
There is a simple way to become Buddha. When you refrain from unwholesome actions, are not attached to birth and death, and are compassionate toward all sentient beings, respectful to seniors and kind to juniors, not excluding or desiring anything, with no designing thoughts or worries, you will be called a Buddha. Do not speak anything else.
So again, I see this kind of motion of moving from complexity to a kind of clear statement of what you can do to practice. There's some supposition that the ending really has the flavor of Shin Buddhism, and there's some speculation. The actual provenance of this. Of Shoji is not clear, you know, where it was written and when. Dr. Abe and I guess some of the Japanese scholars speculate that this was a talk that he gave at a Shin Buddhist temple, which is why he is emphasizing this side of throw yourself into the house of Buddha, which is very much a Shin Buddhist concept. This concept of surrendering to Amida Buddha, and we don't really have evidence. But what I'd like to read for you is. This is a koan. I was talking with Sojin about it, and he said, of course, it's a koan. So this is the unpack, this is Dogen's unpacking of a koan in the record of Zen master Dame. And there's a bunch of stuff about Dame in Andy Ferguson's book, what is it, the Chinese Heritage?
Zen
and the Chinese Heritage. Let me read you the story, and it's the story that is the kind of the whole version of those first two lines. Because the Buddha is in birth and death, there is no birth and death. It is also said, because a Buddha is not in birth and death, a Buddha is not deluded by birth and death. As the monks Jashan and Dingshan were traveling together, they had a discussion. So they're walking along together in the Chinese countryside. Dingshan said, when there is no Buddha within life and death, then there is no life and death. Jashan said, when Buddha is within life and death, there is no confusion about life and death. The two monks couldn't reach any agreement, so they climbed the mountain to see Dame Fashan. Jashan raised their question with Dame and asked, we'd like to know which viewpoint is most intimate. In other words, who's right here? Dame said, this is an interesting response. He says, go away, come back tomorrow. And the next day, Jashan again came to Dame and raised the question of the previous day. Dame said, the one who's intimate doesn't ask. The one who asks isn't intimate. And then in parentheses it says, years later, when Jashan was an abbot, he said, at that time I lost my eye. What does he say? Dr. Abe translates this a little differently. Dr. Abe says, I translate this, at that time I lacked the eye. It's a little different. Let me read it again, and then I think this is a good place to stop, and we'll come back later. Take Dame's position. I think it's, you know, this, why he sent him away is really, to me, that's like the pivot of this, you know. It's like, and I'm curious to know what you think about that. As the monks Jashan and Dingshan were traveling together, they had a discussion. Dingshan said, when there is no Buddha within life and death, then there is no life and death. Jashan said, when Buddha is within life and death, there is no confusion about life and death. The two monks couldn't reach any agreement, so they climbed the mountain to see Dame Fashan. Jashan raised their question with Dame and asked, we'd like to know which viewpoint is most intimate. Dame said, go now, come back tomorrow. The next day, Jashan again came to Dame and raised the question of the previous day. Dame said, the one who's intimate, which is Dingshan, doesn't ask. Well, the one who doesn't ask is Dingshan. Let's say that. The one who's intimate doesn't ask, and the one who asks isn't intimate. Years later, when Jashan was abbot, he said, at that time, I lost my eye, or I didn't have an eye.
I realized I didn't have an eye.
Yeah. I lacked an eye. At that time, I lacked the eye. Just not to leave it hanging totally here. Dr. Abe writes, while both Jashan and Dingshan refer to the idea that samsara is nirvana, nirvana is samsara, the former speaks of liberation from birth and death, emphasizing that Buddha is not apart from birth and death. The latter indicates that same liberation more clearly, emphasizing that birth and death is absolutely birth and death, without respect to Buddha or anything else. In the full episode quoted above, Dame says one is close and one far. but Dogen judges them as equal, emphasizing the non-duality of samsara and nirvana, and especially to show that not hating samsara and not desiring nirvana is the attainment of the Buddha. So, I think we'll stop there and pick this up this afternoon. We have about a slightly shorter session this afternoon, but we can explore this, and I'd like to explore this koan, and I'd also really like to explore what he says at the end. You know, what he says, this thing about it's a simple way to become a Buddha. Very encouraging. So,
does that koan have a number in a book?
No, but it's page 89 in Andy Ferguson's book. It's, you know, there's a huge...
Some koans aren't in a book.
What?
Some koans don't have a number in a book.
Well, it has a number in it. It's part of this vast Chinese record of the Zen masters, which is where Andy got it, that has not been translated, I don't believe. And, you know, it's like each of these masters has their own record, and then there's the compilation of his records, but it's not in something as condensed as, say, the Wycliffe record or the Mumenkan. So, thank you.